Frank Willis.
Close Up, a program with opinions, but never more so than this evening. Our guest, Bertrand Russell, mathematician, philosopher. At 86, still one of the world's most controversial figures. Disagree with him, you may. Ignore him, you can't. For Close Up, Elaine Grant.
Where were you educated, Lord Russell?
At home, by governesses and then tutors. I didn't go to school.
Do you think that's preferable?
It depends what you want. It's preferable from the point of view of acquiring knowledge. I certainly acquired more knowledge than I should have done at school. But, of course, from the point of view of getting on with other people, it's not preferable.
Was your childhood then a very disciplined one, the way you were brought up?
Yes, I was brought up on a very strict discipline. I was brought up by a grandmother who was a Scotch Presbyterian, and with the very rigid morality that Scotch Presbyterians had. It was, for instance, all food was of the utmost simplicity, and even what little nice food there was only given to grown-ups, because it was held that anything a child liked to eat must be bad for its moral character.
What were your pleasures then as a child?
Oh, I had lots of pleasures, because there was a very large garden and a very delightful garden in which I was free to play as I liked by myself, and I did. And I had a lot of pleasure. And then I was passionately addicted to skating. And there were more cold winters just at that time than usual. And I got a great deal of skating and enjoyed that quite enormously.
You say you used to play by yourself in the garden. Were you a solitary child?
Yes, I was. I had a brother 7 years older than myself, but he was away at school or at university, so he hardly counted in my childhood.
Were you never lonely then?
Yes, I suppose I was, but I didn't know it. I mean, I wasn't aware of it. Children are not aware of something that's always been there.
How old were you when you first learned to read?
Oh, I think the usual sort of age. 5 years old, I think.
And what were the books that you read when you were a child and when you were an adolescent that influenced you, inspired you, gave you this desire for knowledge?
Oh, the desire for knowledge didn't come from books. I had that anyhow. I mean, that's innate, I think. Books, well, I don't think books in childhood did influence me. In adolescence, enormously. I read very widely in adolescence.
Were you influenced by any of the great men of that time? When you were an adolescent?
I was influenced by John Stuart Mill. I think he was the only contemporary. Before that, I was more influenced by Shelley, I think, than by anybody else.
It was during your adolescence, of course, that mathematics first fascinated you, wasn't it?
Well, I was 11 when mathematics first fascinated me.
What was it that fascinated you? Can you remember the...
Oh,
was
yes.
There a moment, a day, when you said, this is what I want
yes,
to know about?
Yes. My brother set to work to teach me Euclid. And the moment that I began on Euclid, he said, this is lovely stuff. I didn't know there was anything so nice in the world. Because it proved things. And it seemed to me so nice to have something proved.
Education, of course, is, I suppose, the most important thing to you in the world. I mean, the education of the young and the not-so-young.
I don't know whether it's the most important thing. I think it is certainly very important.
I would think, though, isn't it our only hope of changing the world to the... or your only hope, changing the world to the pattern that you think will be good for human beings through education?
Well, of course, it has two entirely different functions. One is instruction, and the other is the formation of character. And they're not, I say, they're not entirely different. But I think as the amount of knowledge in the world increases, it's very important to find quicker ways of conveying knowledge. You have to get more and more easy ways of instruction if people are not to remain ignorant of important things. This is regards instruction. As regards other things, well, I think the important thing is to teach people that in the modern world there is an extraordinary amount of interdependence, very much more than there was before, and that the interests of each are the same as the interests of all, and that the days of competition are done, or ought to be done, and to continue with competition is to go on living in an outdated technical world.
Now that's what education should be.
Yes.
What do you think education is at the moment?
Well, education is, in the first place, various tricks for getting a better income, and in the second place, a pack of lies by which you will think that the most important thing you can do is to kill foreigners.
A little less than a year ago, you said, addressing the campaign for nuclear disarmament, at present, it seems an even chance whether any human beings will exist 40 years hence. Do you think our chances have increased or decreased since you said that?
That is a question which you can only test by experiment, and I hope the experiment won't be made. We don't know. I think if a nuclear war started tomorrow, a certain number of people in the southern hemisphere would survive. But I think if it started 10 years hence, probably nobody would, because they're always making the weapons a bit worse.
Something that I don't understand is that I think nearly every scientist, physicist and geneticist in the world, those people whom we respect, we say they're the experts who understand what nuclear warfare is, have said, if you do this thing, you will destroy the world, right? Why has nothing happened? Why did the statesmen ignore the scientists? Why did the ordinary citizens ignore the scientists?
Well, let us begin with the statesmen. The statesmen keep a certain number of tame scientists who say the opposite of what every disinterested scientist knows to be the truth. And the statesmen choose to believe their tame people instead of the disinterested people. That is as far as the statesmen go. There are the scientists who are paid and the scientists who are not paid. The scientists who are not paid are all in agreement. So are the scientists who are paid. Really, it's true. I mean, the public doesn't realize that these men lie for money. Intentional lies, because that's where he gets his income. Just like a parson. As far as the general public goes, it finds the whole subject disagreeable and refuses to think about it.
Do you think that that people just ignore the whole problem, then?
The ordinary person, yes. The ordinary person in the street, the uneducated person, ignores it and thinks, oh, well, it's very tiresome. They say it won't happen.
You feel you've accomplished nothing, then, in your campaign?
Oh, I don't say nothing, no, because in the first place we've got all the scientists stirred up tremendously, and that is a very great thing to have done. In the second place, we're gradually percolating, but at present we haven't percolated to the quite unintelligent general public, but I think it can be done in time.
But I think if you say it's only a 50-50 chance for survival, that one can't afford to wait for this percolation to get through to the general public.
Oh, well, because it all depends on whether there is a nuclear war or not. And I think, with any luck, there won't be a nuclear war in the next 10 years. And during those 10 years, a great deal can be accomplished.
Do you think that in any way you have weakened your campaign by asking for a complete stoppage of tests rather than complete disarmament?
Well, you see, the point about tests, there are two points about tests. One is that every test through fallout does harm. Every test causes a certain number of cancers, a certain number of idiocies. You can't tell how many, because those things occur anyhow, and you can't tell whether they're due to a test or not. But there seems very little doubt that, well, I think the ordinary estimate is that the tests already carried out have caused at least 50,000 cancers, apart from the genetic effects. That's the first point. The second point is that agreement about anything, whatever, is to the good. And there is a possibility of getting agreement about abolishing tests. And that would be a first step towards further agreements.
What about those people and many sensible people who feel quite sincerely that the only way to gain peace is to have the bomb as a deterrent, and that to keep the bomb as a useful weapon, one must keep on testing it so it doesn't become obsolescent?
Well, as to that, you have to look, I think, at the history of arms races, of which there have been a great many. And every arms race there has ever been has ended in war, without exception.
Well, another common thing, and again, I think it is a sincere belief, I think there are many people who feel that they would rather be dead than live under what is usually called communist slavery. What answer can you give them? They feel it would be immoral to accept life at any price.
Well, I ask them whether they think they're the only people in the world. I mean, I myself would certainly rather die than live under a communist tyranny, or indeed any other tyranny. But I don't think that on that ground I have a right to say that every inhabitant of India should die. I have no right. It's a piece of persecution to say that they should die for my convictions. It isn't as if only I were involved. All the populations of the world. And, of course, you must remember that exactly the same feelings exist among earnest communists. The earnest communist will feel that he would rather die than live under a capitalist world. Well, both sentiments are foolish. When you extend them beyond yourself, you have a perfect right to sacrifice your own life. You do not have a right to sacrifice the life of the whole of mankind.
Lord Russell, I know that you believe that unilateral disarmament, that if England gives up the bomb completely, not just tests, but disarms, that she will have moral influence over both America and Russia. You do believe that, don't you?
Well, I think that is... I don't think my position on that point has been quite understood. It isn't exactly moral influence that I'm thinking of. I'm thinking of is the extension of nuclear weapons to new powers, which is imminent. And I think it increases the danger of nuclear war very much if a lot of new powers get nuclear weapons. So that I should like to see, as a first step, nuclear weapons confined to Russia and America. And I don't think that Britain can lead a campaign in that sense except by being willing, as the result of an agreement, to give up its own bombs. And I think we ought to say, if an agreement can be reached that only Russia and America are to have nuclear bombs, we will come in and not object to it.
I don't see the advantage that would give the world if Russia and America, who are still the two giants of power, retain their bonds. The threat of war is still with us.
The threat of war is there. It's only a first step. It's not a final solution.
Well, what is the final solution, then?
The final solution, if you want to come to that, is international government, with only one government having armaments at all, and that government international. That's the only final solution. But what one's got to do is to alter public opinion and alter governmental opinion, and make both America and Russia grasp the fact that it's to the interest of both to make sincere friends of each other. And I think in time you could make both the governments understand that.
Do you have more faith or more trust in Mr. Khrushchev than you have in...
No, I have no faith or trust in anybody in politics at all, of any party. But I think that Khrushchev is more aware of the self-interests of Russia than Mr. Dulles is of the self-interests of the United States. I think he's a cleverer man.
You feel that the people who govern us and who rule us and therefore who form our lives have no sense. They're not listening to reason. Well, why don't we just get rid of them? And it's a very frightening proposition to hear a man of wisdom say the men who control the world are not rational.
Well, they never have been. There's never been a period since Cain and Abel when the people who controlled the world were rational.
Will there ever be a time like that? What for?
The only hope, and this is a thing where nuclear weapons give one a gleam of a new hope, that the penalty of irrationality is much greater than it used to be. And therefore one hopes, with, as I say, a 50-50 hope, one hopes that people will grasp the penalties of going on with the old prestige politics, which just won't do in a nuclear age.
Do you think that the form of government you envision in the federal world government, the one government on this earth, will be based upon democracy as we know it?
Oh, I should expect it to be based neither upon democracy nor upon the other. I should expect each nation to have complete freedom of choosing its own form of government.
Which form of government would you wish to live under?
Oh, I prefer democracy.
But you spoke, several things that you've just said sounded as if you felt it was a failure. You said the ordinary citizen was rather stupid, didn't care, the statesmen were irrational.
I quite agree that democracy is very far from perfect, but any other system is worse. It's not that I think democracy good, it is that I think it less bad than any other system.
But what are the bad things within democracy? We like to think that we live within a perfect system in the Western world.
Oh, that's absurd. Nothing human is perfect. Of course, our system of democracy is not perfect because individual human beings are not perfectly wise. You can't expect them to be. You can't expect a collection of people of only very limited wisdom suddenly, because they're united in a government, to display perfect wisdom. Of course they won't. But I think you can say this, that in a democracy, there is much less likelihood of cruel oppression of the great majority of the population than there is in any other system. And it's because of the appalling evils of undemocratic systems that I believe in democracy.
In your lifetime, Lord Russell, you've lived through and seen two enormous social revolutions. One, the diminishing, at least, of a rigid class system in this country, and the other, the so-called emancipation of women. And I was wondering if you approved of what has happened to women in the past 50 years.
Oh, yes, most emphatically. I mean, as soon as I grew up, I became a very keen advocate of equality for women, which in those days was a very, very passionate issue. And women, on the whole, have achieved equality, and the results are almost exactly what I expected.
Do you think the women you know now are happier than women were?
Oh, yes.
Women often feel that the kind of freedom they've been offered is a false freedom. It's only a
certain thing. Because they don't know what women's lives were like in the old days.
What were they like?
Well, I mean, a woman who had a child a year until she died of it had a miserable existence.
But surely that has nothing to do with emancipation.
Oh,
it has something to do with birth control, doesn't
yes,
it?
But that's a result of emancipation.
Do you feel, then, that the introduction of birth control into Asia will mean that their women, who are at this point completely unemancipated, will be, say, in 50 years, emancipated women?
I think so. I think less than 50 years, much less.
I sometimes have the feeling that you consider women inferior to men.
Me?
Yes.
I certainly don't.
You've said that they don't have the talent for happiness, instinctive happiness, that men have.
I can't remember that. I should like you to produce the quotation, because I don't much believe in it.
It's actually in Conquest of Happiness, that in the English-speaking world, that women have less instinct for happiness. That the phrase is instinct for happiness.
Well, I don't remember saying it. If I did, I think it was a silly remark.
A whim. Not something meant at all. You also said, now, I know it's annoying, this was written 20 years ago, wasn't it,
yes.
The Conquest of Happiness?
Yes.
And perhaps you'd had a bad breakfast that morning.
No, it was more than 20 years ago.
You've also said that women are more envious than men because they regard every other woman as a competitor, whereas men don't.
Well, that, I think, is true. I mean, the point is that sexual competition is a more important part of a woman's life as a rule than of a man's. And so women regard other women as a man in an office regards the other people in his office, but not as he regards all other men. That I think is true.
So then how can we ever be emancipated?
Through being less dependent upon sexual matters for success.
What in your life have you found makes a woman attractive?
Oh, goodness,
in the widest sense.
I couldn't possibly tell you. I think it's a combination of attractive appearance and brains is what I like.
Again, looking back, the people you've known, and you've known so many of the great and influential men of the Western world, whom have you admired most?
Certainly in the intellectual world, I should say Einstein, without a doubt. I admired him enormously, and I loved him too. He was a most delightful man.
Yeah. What was he like as a friend?
Well, he was extremely simple, extremely unaffected. You never heard him say or do anything for effect, but always just quite sincerely, because that was what he thought and felt.
And can I ask you about your own personal beliefs? You're not a Christian.
No.
Why are you not a Christian?
Because I see no evidence whatever for any of the Christian dogmas. I've examined all the stock arguments in favor of the existence of God, and none of them seem to me to be logically valid.
Do you think there's a practical reason for having a religious belief for many people?
Well, there can't be a practical reason for believing what isn't true. That's quite, at least I rule it out as impossible. Either the thing is true or it isn't. If it is true, you should believe it, and if it isn't, you shouldn't. And if you can't find out whether it's true or whether it isn't, you should suspend judgment. But you can't, it seems to me, a fundamental dishonesty and a fundamental treachery to intellectual integrity to hold a belief because you think it's useful and not because you think it's true.
Well, I was thinking of those people who find that some kind of religious code helps them to live their lives. It gives them a very strict set of rules, the rights and the wrongs.
Yes, but those rules are generally quite mistaken. A great many of them do more harm than good. And they would probably be able to find a rational morality that they could live by if they dropped this irrational, traditional, taboo morality that comes down from savage ages.
But are we, perhaps, the ordinary person, perhaps isn't strong enough to find this own personal ethic? They have to have something imposed upon them from outside.
Oh, I don't think that's true. And what is imposed on you from outside is of no value, whatever. It doesn't count.
Well, you were brought up, of course, as a Christian. When did you first decide that you did not want to remain a believer in the Christian ethic?
I never decided that I didn't want to remain a believer. I decided between the ages of 15 and 18, I spent almost all my spare time thinking about Christian dogmas and trying to find out whether there was any reason to believe them. And by the time I was 18, I discarded the last of them.
Do you think that that gave you an extra strength in your life?
Oh, I don't know. No, I shouldn't have said so. Neither extra strength nor the opposite. I mean, I was just engaged in the pursuit of knowledge.
As you approach the end of life, do you have any fear of some kind of afterlife, or do you feel that that is just an
impossibility? No, I think that's nonsense.
There is no afterlife?
None whatever.
Do you have any fear of something that is common amongst atheists and agnostics, who have been atheists or agnostics all their lives, who are converted just before they die to a form of religion?
Well, you know, it doesn't happen nearly as often as religious people think it does. Because religious people, most of them, think that it's a virtuous act to tell lies about the deathbeds of agnostics and such. As a matter of fact, it doesn't happen very often.
And finally, if there was something that you could leave the world, aside from your many works and words of wisdom, what one message would you want to say to all the people of the world?
Well, I think I should say to all people of the world two things. One, try as hard as you can to discard your personal passions when you're trying to get at the truth of anything. And second, realize that in the modern world, competition leads to death and cooperation leads to life. That we have the possibility of a happier world than has ever existed if we can drop the habit of competition and of each trying to get ahead of the other and cooperate instead, and that applies especially in international politics.
What are or have been the things that have given you the greatest personal pleasure in your life?
Oh, dear. Well, that's rather a difficult question, isn't it? I think, of course, passionate private relations perhaps would come first of all. And then I've got immense pleasure from natural beauty and intellectual pleasure, understanding something that had been puzzling. And the moment comes when you understand it, and that is a very delightful moment.
Bertrand Russell in reflective mood with Elaine Grand.